Yesterday, I talked about the Society of the Spectacle and Guy Debord, and I asked questions like, imagine a world where the media and the mass media and social media simply did not exist. How would we have experienced massive events that we imagine are massive events, such as the death of Princess Diana, 9/11, and more recently, the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic? All of these things we experienced as massive mass events. And yet, if the media didn't exist, there's a question as to whether we would have known if they had taken place at all. Now, the theorist who took this idea to its logical endpoint was called Jean Baudrillard. There he is. I'll get out of the way so you can see his cool French smoking face. And he argued that not only do we live in an age of mass media, in an age of spectacle, but it has come to the point where the media mediates knowledge, mediates experience to such an extent that it has turned representation into nothing but a simulation. We have left behind the age in which signs and images referred to an external real world. In the current stage, signs no longer represent anything outside themselves. They generate a reality of their own. This is the order of simulation, a substitution that erases the original distinction between the copy and the real. The sign has severed its referent. What remains is the code. Now, just as I was asking about events like Princess Diana's death and 9/11 and so on, and you know, if the media hadn't been there, would we even experience them at all, or would we have seen them as being significant? Baudrillard actually wrote an entire book called, or was it like a long essay, I think it was, pamphlet, called The Iraq War Did Not Take Place. Now, by that, he does not mean that there was literally no Iraq War. What he's talking about is our experience of the Iraq War, you know, aside from a few men who went over there to fight, so actual like real people in the army, the actual Iraqis who were killed in that war, and the actual participants caught up in it, you know, he's not saying that people didn't have built, you know, buildings weren't blown up and people didn't lose their lives. He's not being callous. What he's saying is that our experience of it in the West was as a simulation, and all of the discourse around the Iraq War as it was experienced in the media referred to nothing outside of itself. It's kind of hermetically sealed, symbolic order that talks to and references nothing outside of its own codes. We'll explore this a little bit more as we go on, but generally speaking, this situation is what we call hyper reality. Probably easier than the Iraq War to get one's head around is modern day social media. A couple of months back, I deleted my Twitter account. It had over 65,000 followers at the time. And, you know, many people like to follow me on Twitter, and I spent a lot of time making tweets and things like that. But now, having spent, you know, months off Twitter, you realize that Twitter in itself is a kind of Baudrillard-like situation of hyper-reality, where entire events take place only on Twitter. And the people talking about them refer to nothing but people talking about it on Twitter. And if you were to, you know, try to map what had happened on Twitter, well, it boils down to, you know, let's say Elon Musk. Sorry, my writing is appalling. Let's just say Musk said this. Okay, then this other guy. Says this, then this woman reacts, okay? Then Musk reacts, okay? Now, let me just make my screen larger so you can see my very poorly drawn diagram here. Right, this is a typical kind of outrage cycle, news cycle that is generated on Twitter, by Twitter, for Twitter. And each one of these nodes in this circle, right, going this way, could generate thousands and thousands and thousands of likes and comments, and people are talking about it, people making YouTube videos on here. And the media now, if you've noticed, you know, there'll be a report, an actual news report in a newspaper on Musk saying this. Then on this other guy saying this on Twitter about what Elon Musk said. And then this woman reacting to what this dude said. And then Elon Musk getting back involved and reacting to what this woman said. Okay. Now, this is a hyper-real situation. It refers to nothing outside itself. It has no significance whatsoever to anything at all. Okay, like I said, it's hermetically sealed, right? And it's a symbolic order that has no reference point outside of itself. This is the hyper-real situation. This is the simulation that Baudrillard is talking about. Now, if you think about the experience of the Iraq war, okay, the players would have changed, the mechanism would have changed, but ultimately it's like George Bush said this, and, you know, this has happened, and here's a report from Raggy Omar, and whatever. You basically end up with a similar sort of thing, and the way it is processed, and this is the important thing, the way it is processed at home is as a set of codes. Let's get back here to get into this a little bit further. So hyperreality is the condition in which simulations and models become more real than the real itself. The distinction between true and false, real and imaginary, collapse entirely. And again, you know, this is after Baudrillard died, so he didn't live to see this, but he wouldn't have been surprised, I don't think. Again, Donald Trump is a very hyper-real figure. Entire news cycles have come and gone and come and gone, many of which you will have long forgotten about, okay? Or maybe if we just try to jog our memories, we can remember, you know. Do you remember the whole Donald Trump cusses out Vladimir Zelensky in the White House and makes him seem like, you know, kind of embarrasses him? Right, that was a whole news cycle, huge column inches, and, you know, gallons of ink was spilt on that story, and hours of YouTube content was produced, and thousands and millions of tweets reacted to it all. Okay, such that hyper-real event kind of became... Now, one of the interesting things is there's a commentator here on YouTube called Brian Balesic. I talked about him before, the New Atlas, who all throughout that said, look, nothing's happened here. There's been absolutely no change in US policy. There's been no change in the orientation of NATO towards Russia. You know, this is all nonsense. This is all noise. This is all theater. Now, I can't remember exactly when that event happened, but it was sometime last year. We're now a whole year later, and Brian Balesic was right. Absolutely nothing has happened. In fact, the drums of war bang ever louder when it comes to that whole situation. So this is a typical Trumpian hyper-real situation, okay? Now, the thing with Donald Trump is that because he's so bombastic, because he's so over the top, he makes all of this more visible. He makes it easier to see. But Baudrillard was not only talking about larger-than-life figures like Donald Trump, but the whole show, the whole thing, right? Okay, substitute Donald Trump with somebody really dull, like Keir Starmer, for example, or John Major, right, who would have been around in the 90s there. These are no less hyper-real figures. And it's not simply mainstream politics or, you know, top line. It is the whole thing. It is the whole media and social media environment. The whole spectacle creates this hyper-real situation. The media circulates images without origin. It produces self-referential reality more vivid than lived experience. And if you think about this, you know, this is one of the reasons, one of many reasons, I've always been so interested in pro wrestling, because Vince McMahon built an entire hyper-real world in the WWF, WWE, such that wrestling fans will instantly be able to transport themselves through these postcard moments in wrestling history. So when I say it's Andre the Giant staring down Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 3, what was it, Pontiac Silverdome, right? You know exactly where I'm talking about. You know exactly the time and the place, because it's been played and played and played and repeated and looped over decades now on television. And the thing that people remember is the moment. Okay, now, in exactly the same way, and there are other moments, Hulk Hogan and The Rock at WrestleMania 17, Stone Cold Steve Austin and Bret Hart, whatever you want to, whatever memories that you can have, it all works in the same way, okay? And wrestling is a very good example of the hyper-real because it refers to nothing outside of it. It is a self-contained world, okay, of, in this case, Vince McMahon's creation. It is just has its own internal logic. It means nothing to anybody really outside of it. And yet those people who are in it, you know, understand the symbolic order that is represented by these postcard moments. What Baudrillard is saying, though, is that basically the whole of culture exists in this way, that the self-referential reality, these repeated images that are shown again and again and again, they, in a strange way, become more real than whatever was actually happening at the time. As I talked about, I think the death of Princess Diana was a particularly hyper-real moment, and I remember it vividly. But how do I remember it vividly? Because I wasn't there. I didn't know Princess Diana, but I experienced it as a media spectacle. I experienced it as a media event. And during the course of that thing, certain images of Princess Diana were repeated again and again and again. And see, the thing is, you forget about these, but anybody who was around at the time will remember the little look up she did at Martin Bashir, right? That was repeated over and over and over again. And the media loves to build up these symbolic kind of shorthands where and then you kind of instantly recognize it, you tap into what that thing is, and you're straight back there. Even though this is something that refers to nothing else, really. And the only reason that we recognize it is because it's just been repeated endlessly by the mass media. Statistical, economic, and political models precede and shape the phenomenon they purport to describe. And Baudrillard talks about the code, DNA, digital, semiotic, replaces substance as the governing logic of reality. Now we'll get more in depth on a lot of these things, because this is really the archetypical French kind of postmodern theorist. It can take a while to get your head around it. Hopefully you've been following me so far. I'll just remind people that I sell courses at the Academic Agency. Buy it now. Trivium is the bestseller. Many other great courses available. But let's get back to the lecture at hand. So the other big idea that Baudrillard has is simulacra. In the classic formula, the map was the imitation of the territory. So the territory makes the map. You know, somebody conquers some land and then somebody else comes along and does a map on it. But in the new hyper-real symbolic order, this is inverted. The map now precedes and produces the territory. Reality is no longer the source from which models are derived. Models themselves generate reality. The simulation comes first, what we call the quote-unquote real is its residue. Now, this really goes quite deep, quite far, whether or not Baudrillard had these things in mind or not, because if you know anything about economics, so much of what we think of as the quote-unquote the economy is the economy doing well is based on models. A lot of it is not based on what Thomas Sowell would call real flesh and blood human beings. They're based on mathematical models. We've been experiencing an extremely hot summer here in the UK. Okay. And this is being taken as proof everywhere of man-made climate change, which is a lived reality for many people. But is it? Or is it a Baudrillardian hyper-reality produced almost exclusively by mathematical models? Well, that's a question I'll just leave posing out there, okay? But it is a good encapsulation of what Baudrillard is talking about. What came first? Was it the model? Was it the map? Or was it the real thing? So let us continue. Now, his favorite example is Disneyland. Disneyland exists in order to make the rest of America appear real by contrast. It is presented as overtly imaginary so that we can believe the surrounding world is genuine. In fact, both are simulations. Disneyland simply makes the simulation visible. So Disneyland actually goes out of its way to show you that it's a simulation. So strictly speaking, Disneyland is just more honest about itself than the rest of society or the rest of the places that we think of as being quote unquote real, because it makes the simulation visible. In doing so, it conceals the far more total simulation that lies outside its gates. So yes, Disneyland is a simulation, but it actually advertises itself as such. Whereas when you walk down the actual high street, that does not advertise itself as a simulation of your reality. Now, what is Baudrillard talking about? Well, you see, the totality of the symbolic order is such that even the experience of walking down a real high street is prefigured almost totally by these signs, which have no referent to anything other than themselves. Now, I'll come back a second, because I have really stopped watching television and I don't really watch movies anymore. And I haven't really experienced, you know, especially since I'm not on Twitter anymore. I don't have that many links back to the kind of hyper-reality that Baudrillard is talking about. But I did, through habit and just because, you know, kind of made me, I'm always interested to see how England get on. I did watch the World Cup. And there were several, the World Cup was held in America, which is, you know, not only a tragedy, not only an absolute tragedy to hold, you know, because they didn't even watch football in America, soccer, right? Not only that, though, but because it was held in America, there was this hyper-real sense around the games and around, I mean, this, the World Cup final had this horrible spectacle, a halftime show, where Madonna came out, and it was all, you know, that in itself was a horrible simulation of something. But what it really brought home to me as somebody who has been kind of out of it, kind of that, right, they were frequently panning to people in the crowd, and it would just linger there. And then the person in the crowd would do something. Now, the person that, like, let's just pretend, I'll put these straight, right? Some guy in the crowd watching the football, and then the camera would go to them and he'd go, he'd look at the camera and he'd go, and he'd do some like little movement or little catchphrase, or he'd go like, or something like that, as if to say, oh, this is someone I meant to, oh, right, the camera's panning to this guy because he's not just a random bloke in the crowd. This is a famous actor or some. Now, I don't know anybody anymore. I don't know any famous people. So I was like, it took me a while to twig. Oh, I'm meant to know this guy from this show or from that show. And that little thing he does is like a little catchphrase. Oh, it's a little gimmick. I meant to recognize him. And it's being done in this corny and cheesy way because, you know, America, you know, the most Baudrillardian society ever made. Okay. The most hyper real place ever, you know, real life Disneyland. But it brought home to me the fact that when even you're a little bit outside, okay, now let's say the amount of time in maybe 5 or 6 years that I don't really pay attention, I don't really watch TV anymore, I don't really know, my knowledge is now dated, like I know people from the 80s and the 90s, I don't really know anybody now. I'm only like 5 years removed. And yet the experience of all of that, to come back to Disneyland, just brought home how artificial and constructed and self-referential the whole world of the media is. Oh, I meant to know that. Oh, that's the guy from that. Well, I don't care, though. I'm just watching football. Oh, right. You presuppose I watch this thing. Everybody presupposes everybody else knows what's going on here because this is a self-referential hyper-real world. Okay, and these are the moments that you can start to recognize what he's talking about. I mentioned before, I have a friend who's been on the channel many times, Stephen Carson. He goes by Radical Liberation. He hasn't watched TV for 30 years. And he says every time he watches it, every time he catches a glimpse, it is super fake. It is like so, he cannot believe anybody watches it. And yet for many people, for millions of people, billions of people, that is reality. It's not, you know, it is their, they see it as normal and natural. And, you know, my buddy Stephen is the freak, right? But it's a very strange thing when you experience it. And so it's a little bit like recognizing that the world outside is as constructed, as total, as Disneyland. Now there's two other references I can make here, since I've already got, you know, everybody's seen, speaking of wrestling, or everybody knows at least the memes from the Rowdy Roddy Piper film They Live, and the moment where he looks at the billboard and then he sees reality for what it is, and then he puts the, right, it's a little bit like that. The other example I was going to give, let's stick with the Rowdy Roddy Piper. Let's not over complicate matters. What I was going to say was, you know, years ago on my show Unpopular Opinions, one of the very first things I said, I think like the first or the second unpopular opinion I had, was that Disneyland and theme parks in general are totalitarian in nature. That a theme park is a totalitarian experience. Okay, think about it. You're told where to stand, right? You spend most of the day queuing. Then you're strapped into a thing, right? You're told, put these things on, strap yourself in, have fun. Now you have fun. You laugh now. You pose for the picture now. Okay. That's the experience of going to a theme park. And if you think about it, even for a second, it is totalitarian in nature. If you went to a theme park and did not do the things that you were expected to do as a kind of fat slob tourist that you are when you're there, if you don't play the game, you will quickly find yourself ushered or told off, or, you know, it's really quite a totalitarian environment. And they keep it super duper clean there as well, in places like Disneyland and in a good theme park. It is, you know, kept with military precision. That is quite an interesting metaphor then for the whole of society. And, you know, since I've got a 6-year-old daughter, I've had more recent experiences of going to the theme park. And I have to say, you know, going, right, so the experience of going there as a youngster, having so much fun, guys. Let's pay the £5 for the picture, right? All of that. But then going there as a, you know, as a dad with, let's say, a four-year-old. She's six now, but let's say she was four. The almost insulting nature that the mums and dads are treated. I mean, you really are treated as cattle in most theme parks. It's like, oh, you know, you stand there now. You know, here it is. Here's some entertainment. You know, some puppet show for you to watch. It is almost derogatory. It's almost insulting. And yet, it is a very accurate analogy for the society that we live in at large. Society at large is a little bit like taking a kid to a theme park and being mildly insulted as an adult man. So let's continue. So he talks, Baudrillard does, about media saturation and the implosion of meaning. The endless circulation of images does not produce enlightenment. Messages cancel each other out, leaving indifference where understanding was promised. There is a paradox of information. More data, more channels, more noise, and yet less comprehension. These days with the internet, it's not just, you know, when I was a kid, there was four channels. Actually, I grew up in Wales, so really we had three channels and the fourth one was in Welsh, watching Poblacom or whatever. I can't speak Welsh. So really we had three channels unless I wanted to stay up to watch Friends at midnight, which is when it was shown on S4C. But then at some point there was the explosion of free, you know, UK TV Gold and Sky TV and all of those sorts of channels. And then there was digital TV. Now there's the internet, where there are literally thousands upon thousands of channels like this to watch on YouTube, or, you know, there's an overload of content, of information, of data. Baudrillard argues that this media system is working as it is designed, to neutralize meaning through excess, to bamboozle, to overload. Everybody now has heard about Steve Bannon's strategy of flooding the zone. I talked about Donald Trump. Donald Trump loves to flood the zone, not just one story, but 10 stories all at once, so that even the journalists can't keep up, let alone the punter at home trying to keep track of the news. Oh, what's happened now? What's happened now? Most of us, with any sense, have decided just to tune Trump out. The only way to deal with that is just, I'm not going to listen to anything. I don't care about anything you say anymore, right? It doesn't matter even if it's about bombing Iran. I just don't care, Donald. You've kind of, after 10 years of it, I've had enough. But what Baudrillard is saying, it's not just Donald Trump. It's the entire media. It's the entire mass simulation system. The entire society, the spectacle, is like this. This is the Matrix. In the end, nothing means anything, because nothing refers to anything. It's just one mass of drivel, slop, and noise at the end of the day, such that if you turned it off, if you deleted your Twitter account, if you stopped watching the news, you probably wouldn't be missing anything. The masses themselves are like a black hole. They do not resist or contest meaning in any traditional political sense. They are basically the crowd of Gustave Le Bon that I talked about a couple of weeks back. Passive, feminine. Almost like, as I've said so many times, pigs waiting to feed at the trough for more. I'll never forget when I went to, there was this cultural phenomenon, brief as it was, of this drink that was brought out by some influencer, Logan Paul. I can't remember, but they brought out this drink called Prime. And you couldn't get any. So as a kind of little entertaining thing for this channel, I want to go out and try to find, I'm going to go out and try to look for some Prime. And so over the course of the week of that, I kind of, you know, consumed a bit of the kind of hype around Prime. Right, the bottles were going for like 20 quid, even though they were retailing it to, you know, shops were hoarding up bottles of Prime and things like this. And I'll never forget that there was a media report of normal people scrambling, literally scrambling about. Okay, you know, a ruckus in the shop to try to get their bottle of Prime. And from a certain point of view, it's difficult not to think of Monty Python's pastiche of the peasantry in Life of Brian or in Holy Grail. You know, Eric Idle with the mud on his face. You know. Let's get back to the masses as the black hole. They absorb, neutralize, and dissolve all messages, functioning like a gravitational singularity that swallows information without reflection or response. And I'm sorry to say this, but you will know people. You'll probably be related to people. You may even be one of these people who is part of this mass. I have seen old people's brains warped by the media. There is a certain generation of person, typically boomers, who, if they do not have something validated by the television, they simply will not believe that it is true. They need the television to tell them that something is real, to have it confirmed as being real. This is the hyper-real situation that they live in. And I'm sorry to say, this could be loved ones of yours, it could be your partner, it could be your mother and father. Could be your siblings, could be your friends, could be you. The masses consume political messaging without internalizing its intent, rendering it inert. Critique fails because even oppositional discourse is absorbed and neutralized by the same gravitational indifference. What was once called the social encompasses collective bonds, shared meaning, and public space. All of this has imploded in the moment of the simulacra, or the simulation, the hyper-real moment. In its place, instead, we have statistical masses, media audiences, and networks of simulation. The social itself has become a simulation. It is performed, it is referenced, it is circulated, but no longer experienced as a lived collective reality. What replaced the social? Polling data, demographic aggregates, broadcast audiences mistaken for the actual public, network connectivity mistaken for actual communities, simulated participation in place of agency. So in this situation, Baudrillard is saying, what are you even talking about, like social concerns? What social? Political straw? What politics? What are you even talking about anymore? There's also been a shift in the dominant logic of the symbolic order, we might say, or the as Foucault would call it, the order of knowledge. Now we get seduction over production. Classical critical theory centered on, you know, he has in mind Marxist theory, really, materialist Marxism. They focused on production, they focused on labor, and labor power, they focused on repression. Baudrillard argues that the dominant logic has shifted decisively to a logic of seduction. The play of appearances, challenge and reversibility. In the production logic, they talked about force, ideology, repression, and the extraction of meaning through labor. In the seduction logic, and the seduction logic is very much, again, the world of Edward Bernays, who I spent a whole lecture on. It is fascination. It is allure. It is surface and surfaces. It is the reversibility of sign. Power operates through enchantment rather than coercion. And if you think about what happened to the left, the classic old left that had the production logic, that has been completely overtaken by the left that have been seduced by symbols, the pride flag, the solidarity fist, the simulacra of the politics of the old politics of revolt and rebellion, now sold back as commodity. Now the left simply seduced by a few symbols and a few corporate HR departments paying lip service to tired talking points from 20 years ago. Entire events are simulations, and I started the whole lecture talking about such events, Princess Diana, 9/11, Iraq War, COVID, wars, scandals, political crises, and terrorism increasingly function as media events stayed within the system of simulation. Their reality is inseparable from their representation. They exist primarily as signs circulating in the media sphere, with their cause, consequence, and meanings determined by the logic of the spectacle rather than by historical necessity. Now, you will forget, I've talked about big ones. Let's talk about little ones that still had, in the media narrative, quite large consequences. Okay. In the simulation of the British media landscape, the British news and politics cycle, there was such a thing as Partygate. Who remembers Partygate? This was during a time of lockdown. Boris Johnson, the erstwhile Prime Minister, had a party and didn't bother doing social distancing rules and didn't abide by the governmental rules of lockdown. Now, this event took place in the media. And yet, I'm not sure if I know a single person who actually cared sufficiently about Partygate that it meant that it had to be the end of Boris Johnson's prime ministerial career. Yet he did actually resign. And yet history will chalk it up that he had to resign due to the scandal of Partygate. Did Partygate take place? Did it really exist? Did it affect anybody? Who cares? In the hyper-real narrative, Partygate was actually really significant. It ended up being the moment that defined the end of the Boris Johnson government. Of course, the things that actually define the Boris Johnson's government are those things that Boris Johnson did while he was in power, not least under cover of night, under cover of lockdown, overseeing the largest influx in immigration in the country's entire history. And yet, in the media landscape, that was secondary, played second fiddle, really, to Partygate. The final problem is the trap of critique. And this is something that possibly people on the, on the right as well as the left might take note of in current year. Every opposition risks absorption. Okay, every opposition risks absorption. The demands for transparency, liberation, and more information can themselves become part of the hyperreal apparatus, feeding rather than disrupting the system. My buddy Scrump and Avelin talk about this every single week on their channel, Scrump Monkey. I have talked about it ad nauseum on this channel. Appeals to expose the truth reinforce the hyperreal frame, assuming there is a hidden real to uncover. Think about all the exposés that we've seen. Does anybody remember the Twitter files, Elon Musk fans? Does anybody remember the Epstein files? Does anybody remember Donald Trump releasing the largest cache of UFO-related documents in American history? Does anybody remember the release of the JFK files? Did any of it amount to anything? Did it change anything? Did anything happen whatsoever? Well, you tell me. Traditional critique reduces the logic of meaning. It seeks to contest, becoming another sign within the system. So your protest becomes just another sign, just another part of the hyperreal landscape, such that whether you're Greta Thunberg with her Greenpeace sign or Nigel Farage with his pint, or you're one of them radical leftists or one of them despicable far righters, or you're a MAGA chud, or you're whoever, you're just another sign with no reference to anything other than itself. And in the online space and in the online world, this is something that people not only are trapped in an endless cycle of hyperreal nonsense, but also then start to get very defensive when you suggest that their protest, their movement hasn't amounted to a whole hill of beans. That actually it's just been doing the function of containment the whole time. If you're interested in that, by the way, I have a whole book on it, Applied Elite Theory, buy it now. But you'll be surprised how resistant people are to seeing the limits of their own resistance. It's going to be different this time, guys. Just one more Tommy Robinson rally. Yeah? One more pussy hat march and you'll bring down the patriarchy. Isn't that right, radical feminists? Baudrillard says that the tough task of people who have radical thought is to operate outside of the logic of representation altogether, which was a strategy that he never fully resolved. And, you know, it is very difficult to do, because once you get too outside of the self-referential system of the logic, you know, people don't like it. They call you names. They start getting defensive. They start trying to defend their little piece of the symbolic order, as we've seen in real time over the years. And that'll be it for today. So, yeah, Baudrillard. Now, he's a difficult thinker, and I hopefully I got towards his, you know, explaining his thought, but there's a lot more to Baudrillard. I've just scratched the surface here. And a lot of these lectures I'm giving are introductory. They're intended for you to explore on your own or to read these people for, you know, for themselves. Every great thinker I'm looking at has something I think worth saying. I'm giving you a little flavor of their core ideas, but, you know, most learning is done not by listening to a lecture like this, but by reading for yourself. The best way you'll know if you've learned something yourself is if you're then able to explain it in your own words to somebody else. Okay. So I encourage people, don't stop with just these lectures. Go on and read on, you know, explore these thinkers yourselves, and then try to explain them to other people. And then you'll know if you know this material or not. Also, you know, I've been explaining these ideas. I have not been interrogating them or giving much by way of whether I agree or disagree. In this case, I do, broadly speaking, agree with the thrust of Baudrillard's analysis. I think that he saw things almost, you know, he saw things early, and time and actually the way the internet has gone, and, you know, kind of cultural touchstones like Donald Trump have only reinforced and, you know, proven him right in the fullness of time. So, yeah, very interesting thinker, very prescient thinker. I do explore him and all of the thinkers I've talked about. I would also, in these weeks, there's an order. I started with Guy Debord. Today I've done Baudrillard. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing Lyotard. On Thursday it's going to be Frederick Jameson. And you'll see there's a reason, there's a logic to why I tackle these in blocks of four, because they speak to each other and against each other in all sorts of interesting ways. So, if you want to read forward, it's Lyotard tomorrow and Jameson the next day. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.